Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna on News Talk.
Yes, you can email the show aliveandkicking@newstalk.com or you will find me on Instagram. I'm at Claire McKenna Presents. Coming up this morning, the importance of early childhood intervention and how, when on wait lists, this can begin at home. I'll also be joined by behavioural change specialist Dr. Heather McKee on the importance of knowing our health markers and what to do with that information. And Niall Breslin on the part of ourselves, which is the place that has never been wounded, the title of his latest album and book. So what kind of a health and wellness week did I have? Well, this was a tough week, I'm not going to lie. I had in my mind that after the house move, the book launch and the retreat, things would calm down a little, but the demands on my week were still relentless. I was also on a panel this week and we were talking about the art of longevity. And on that panel, I quoted the Harvard study of human development, which is actually an ongoing 80-year-old study looking at what helps us live longest and healthiest. And the number one component which directly correlated to health, to happiness and to longevity was strong personal relationships, connection and friendship, basically seen as healthcare. And those friendships and those relationships can help us stave off brain degeneration and have greater mental health long into the end of our lives. And it's quality over quantity too. We only need a couple of people that we could call on in times of crisis. And it's so important that we give time to these friendships. And this week, I was reminded of how lucky I am to have that in my life from my friends at my retreat. I was sent a gorgeous video taken from my Debs 30 years ago by my boyfriend at the time's father. He's now transferring all the VHS tapes to digital. He sent me that. It was like a portal into my past, my dad, my mum, and the same friends who I stood alongside at their wedding and who were there at my retreat are there in that Debs video. So that was just a really lovely thing for me to see. So my health prescription for you this week is to think of who your 3 a.m. people are. Who could you call at that hour and depend on them? Make time for them this week. Could be a catch up, a phone call, a walk or meet over a meal. It's actually an easy investment in your health. And if you don't have those people in your life, consider how you might find your tribe, like-minded people in a class or a club or volunteering in your community. I know it's easier said than done, but it is oh so worth the effort. You can email the show aliveandkicking@newstalk.com. Now, you probably know your PIN off by heart and your car reg, but your cholesterol, your blood sugar, your resting heart rate. New research from Irish Life Health suggests we're a nation that can remember pretty much everything except the numbers that matter most for our long-term health. So why do we avoid the very information that could protect us? And how do we move from knowing to actually doing? I'm joined now by behavioural change specialist, Dr. Heather McKee. Heather, you're very welcome.
Thanks for having me, Claire.
Now, I always say, and I'm sure you're going to be with me, this is not being said in a finger wagging tone, you know, why aren't you learning, you know, because, and there's some people I'm sure say, I forget my PIN all the time, I haven't a clue what my reg number is. But yeah, why is this sort of information important? Why are we trying to empower people to know their numbers and know they're normal?
Yeah, these kind of top five metabolic markers are the primary indicators of your long-term health. And so many of us, you know, are mad into optimization, where we've all got the rings and the watches and everything else, and we want to know all of our sleep stats and our recovery scores and everything else. But actually, sometimes we're missing the point. And the point is, what are these key things that are really matter to our long-term health and well-being? And put these figures back on the map for people.
I think there's a lot of fear as well. People think, let's not go digging. If it's not broke, don't fix it, kind of thing. But this is empowering information to have, isn't it? This is a positive thing. I think people think when they start digging, they're going to have all kinds of negative information come at them. It's the same with therapy. People are like, oh no, I wouldn't want to go digging. Who knows what might come up? Instead of thinking, this could really improve how I feel and the years I have ahead of me.
Yeah. And I think crucially what the research showed was actually that the 35 to 55 age group were the ones that actually tend to ignore these numbers the most. And yes, they've loads going on. You know, we know this age group has life, has family, it's all caring responsibilities, it's work, it's everything else. But yeah, they tended to put their head in the sand, even though they knew that these fears were important. That's what the research showed, that only you know, less than half of them actually engaged in, you know, health checks over the last year. And yeah, fear is often the factor. It's also other things though. You know, sometimes we claim fear, but it might be things like time, cost, friction to actually go out and proactively book an appointment with your GP. It takes a lot of effort. Some people might be embarrassed when there's actually nothing essentially wrong with them. But I do think actually waking up to these figures is really, really important. And it is scary for some people, but actually we're, especially in that 35 to 55 group, it's a time when you can actually take action and really make a meaningful change for your long-term health.
Yeah, and I think we need to flip the switch with how we think about health. And it's not our fault. We have a crisis model of the healthcare system. So we wait for something to go wrong. We go, we seek help. Often we just have the symptoms dealt with. And, you know, in a hospital setting, that's what they're there for, to patch you up. They do incredible work and then they send you on your way. They don't really have time necessarily to give it this holistic view of why this may have happened. And sometimes it was just down to bad luck. Yeah. But other times people need this information. And as you say, they can make little tweaks in their lives. So how do we change having this information and knowledge and turning it into action?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the thing is, like, we all love gathering information. You know, how many of us don't know that in order to be well, we need to eat more vegetables or drink more water or manage our stress. But knowledge isn't always action and information doesn't always equal implementation. And so I think the key things for people are to know what the meaningful metrics are for them. So what does this mean in my life? What is the most important thing in terms of my health right now where I'm at? I think things like the Irish Life Health Check, like, it really helps you realize which ones of the, when, what factors are most salient, what is most important. But once you know that, the next step is really important in terms of, okay, well, what's the smallest change I can make? Because so often when people get these health tests, when they get these results, they think they need to make it this huge lifestyle overhaul. They need to make this transformation. And actually that's really ineffective long-term because you're changing too many things at once. And actually what's most effective is to start with, okay, well, what matters most to me right now? What do I feel most capable doing? And how can I start that in a small way? And what I would say to people as well is stop planning for your best of days, plan for your worst of days. Because so often when it comes to creating any lifestyle change in our life, we think, oh, our future self is going to be full of motivation. You know, they're going to be really well slept. They're going to be in a great mood. And unfortunately, life doesn't work that way. You know, we've got sick kids or sick parents and life happens. And so I always say to people, when we're thinking about change, think about the smallest or the minimum viable habit that you could create over the next week, given life is going to happen, and think about how you can approach that in the smallest, most manageable way for you. And that's what's going to make it way more sticky long term. I often say to people, you know, the habits that stick the best are the ones that feel joyful. And so, you know, if you're considering making a lifestyle change, I always say, well, let's start with joy. So create a joy list. What are those healthy habits that you enjoy? Is it going for a walk with a friend? Is it going for a hike up the mountains with your dog? Is it even just that you like the taste of hot water and lemon? You feel like you're in a spa first thing in the morning. Whatever it is, lighting a candle, using hand cream, you know, it's all well-being. But it's important to focus on those things that bring you joy rather than focus on, you know, what's been taken away, because ultimately we gravitate towards those things that bring us joy. And if you can find joy, it makes everything else a lot easier.
It's really important that we know our numbers, not only on our future self, but how we feel right now. And again, to go back to what I began this interview with, that's not finger wagging. That's empowering. I think people need to be reminded you deserve to feel as good as you can for as long as you can. We only get one shot at this wild and precious life.
Yeah, it's so well said. And I do think, like, don't be scared of the numbers. If you know them now, you can make a difference. You can make that change and you can make that impact. See it as you say, Claire, an empowering next step, not something to be feared. And it's important that we take responsibility and take control of our health, because ultimately that's what leads to having long, happy and lives where we can make a contribution.
Well, behavioural change specialist Dr. Heather McKee, thank you so much for coming on.
Alive and kicking on News Talk. Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Now, if you're a parent waiting on an assessment, you'll know this much. childhood doesn't wait, and families can't press pause while the system catches up. A new book is asking us to rethink how we support our youngest children and their families. Joining me now is clinical psychologist Martin O'Connor, author of Early Childhood Intervention, Time for a New Conversation. Martin, you're very welcome.
Thank you, Claire.
Tell us a little bit about your work and your experience of those wait times that I mentioned.
Well, I've worked many, many years in what's referred to as disability services, both for supporting adults and children and families. I had first-hand experience, I suppose, of the issue of waiting times and waiting for diagnosis when I worked as a clinical manager of children's services in Clare in the Midwest for a period of time. It's usually a period of great stress and frustration for parents in particular. And at times it can seem like, you know, a family's life is put on hold as they wait for this diagnosis to happen. At the same time, I was very struck by an article that I read in the Irish Times back in October 2024, I think it was, which described the situation that you and I are talking about in beautiful detail. It's a beautifully written article by the aunt of a little boy with a developmental disability. And it refers to his mum and dad waiting with frustration for a diagnostic assessment to happen. But the piece that caught my eye at the time was the way in which the little boy is described. And he's described as being able to find his way across the kitchen floor to get from A to B. And getting to B means getting to a favourite toy. And his aunt describes him as doing it not in the normal way, but doing it in his own way. And I just had a light bulb moment of thinking, well, this is child development in action on the kitchen floor. And where is the support for his mum and dad to, if you like, join the dance that he's inviting them into? And I refer on a few occasions in the book that parenting in many ways is a dance led by children. And I suppose if there is a significant difference between typically developing children and children with developmental disability, and additional support needs, is that they do often need additional help themselves to discern and decipher the dance that their child is leading them into. So how the child tries to give communication signals and helping parents to be more aware of when that happens, because these are moments for connection, particularly for children who are autistic.
And I do think you handle that really well throughout the book, because it's a difficult, to borrow your word, dance or line to tread, to meet parents or caregivers of a child with a developmental issue, some compassion for what is happening and accept that, yes, they do deserve support, but to also empower them to lean on their own intuitions and their own parenting. Because as you said in the beginning, often family life can go on hold, and through no fault of their own and with the best of intention, there are parents and caregivers who are sort of waiting to be told what to do. And you really wanted to, as you said there, empower them to know that often the relationship that you have with your child, no one is going to know them better than you.
Absolutely. And I have done some training down through the years with what used to be called early intervention teams. And I've always made the point to people working in the area of what's called early intervention to be very careful and sensitive, particularly in the first meeting you have with a mom and or a dad. Because in reality, you're meeting the world expert on the child. Now, the parent mightn't have a sense of that, because of the issues that have arisen for them entering into this new unknown world. And by that I mean the unknown emotional world that they now find themselves in, and then this new unknown, previously unknown professional world that they now find themselves coming into. And the phrase family-centered, in a way, has become a bit of a buzzword, and its application is sadly often lacking. It's fine to declare it as policy, but the actual practice of it with families can be a different kettle of fish, so to speak, in terms of the impact of it. And what I mean by that is that the fact of there being a child in a family who has additional needs means that the life and learning and development of that child is already family-centered. So services often seem to believe that family-centeredness starts when the family meets with the service. The family centeredness is already entrained from the moment of the birth of the child. So the parent already knows intimate details about this child that a professional can never know. And a parent has a way of knowing and often has developed skills through necessity in terms of what helps the child, what helps the child to feel relaxed, what helps the child to regulate, what helps the child to have fun, what helps the child to participate as best they can in the activities and routines of daily life. And that's child development in action. And that's why I referred in the book in some detail to the framework of what's called the F words for child development. Because in essence, the F words cover what is child development. And for me, that should be the focus of early intervention for children in families. And the F words are basically functioning, how the child engages with and participates in the life of the world around him or her. Family being the main environment, particularly for young children. Family is the main environment. Later on, it might be a creche, might be preschool, maybe junior infants and the early classes in school. But these are the key environments in which children's learning and development happens. And that's the importance of functioning. Fitness, which is often a topic that maybe isn't spoken about as much as it should be in relation to children with additional needs. Not just their physical fitness, but mental health and emotional well-being. A sense that they belong, that they're welcomed, that they're seen, that they're respected, that they're needed and that they're wanted and that they're loved. That's all to do with mental well-being and quality of life. The importance of friends, which can often be a huge challenge for families where you have a child with additional needs. Very often the child will have friends maybe in the early years in school, and then there can be sort of a parting of the ways as the child and other peers get older and develop different interests and so on. So that can be a challenge, but it's very, very important for quality of life and well-being for any child. So I've mentioned functioning, family, fitness, fun, the importance of fun. What is it in the child's life that the child likes to do that makes him or her smile, that makes them laugh? Who do they like to spend time with that brings fun into their lives? And also, last but not least, the importance of future, because child development is always a work in progress. As I said earlier, it might be more difficult to spot it in children with additional needs, developmental disability. But at the same time, to me, that is one of the primary roles of competent professionals, that they're able to help parents to spot the signals that the child is giving, because these are the moments when the child is open for connection. And in that context, in the book, I mentioned the Martha Mayo interaction approach, which I've personal experience of in the past working professionally. And I find it to be a really powerful way, particularly for autistic children in families and in preschool environments, to help parents and the adults around the autistic child to, if you like, begin to move into the world of the child and connect with the world of the child in order to help the child to get a sense of what's going on in the emotional world of other people, which can be a difficult social and emotional challenge for autistic people, autistic children.
You also talk in the book about the culture of parental guilt, and alongside professional perfectionism, it creates a perfect storm. I'd also add the stress, perhaps, of trying to live through all of that into that. So how do people navigate that? What impact is that having?
Research that I carried out back in 2015 with six mothers. I was doing a master's in coaching psychology in UCC at the time, and this was my dissertation topic. And these six mothers kindly agreed to be interviewed by me. And the question I was interested in was, how did they navigate the years that they spent while their child was travelling through, so to speak, children's services? So at the time that I met these mothers and interviewed them, practically all of their children and young people were older than 18 years of age, so they had moved beyond the remit, if you like, of children's disability services. And that research really gives, I think, a very accurate insight to the question that you're asking in terms of how parents have to try and navigate what I mentioned earlier as being a previously unknown emotional world, a previously unknown professional world that they're moving into. And I think very often, and I say this with kindness because I'm a professional healthcare worker myself, or at least I was, I think the degree of sensitivity and ability to build rapport and to take your time, particularly in that first contact meeting with a family, with a parent, is absolutely critical, because parents remember these meetings for many, many a day, indeed for the rest of their lives, just as they do remember how a diagnosis was given to them. Even when they know what the diagnosis is likely to be, there's still something hugely important about how a professional healthcare worker or any medical professional will communicate that information to a family. And the follow-up that's often lacking, it might simply be a phone call a week later after the family received the diagnosis, simply to ask them, well, how are you since we last spoke? Many families have said to me that they would welcome such a phone call, but sadly, very often, it doesn't happen. And that's a moment missed in terms of building relationship between healthcare professionals and families. And in the research that I carried out, the parents talked about their initial feelings of vulnerability. The vulnerability of being told there's something, in inverted commas, wrong with your child. The vulnerability that that brings in play in terms of all the plans and aspirations and hopes and dreams that you had in terms of being a parent and how this changes all of that. And then the additional vulnerability that happens when parents meet with healthcare professionals for the first time, perhaps being asked the same questions as they've previously been asked. And I always make the point to healthcare professionals, in that first meeting that you have with parents, take time to ask them about all the other professionals they've met up to that point, because their journey has already begun before you meet with them. They probably already have met with a paediatrician or a consultant, a public health nurse, a GP, and so forth. And be interested and curious about what have those professionals said to this parent about their child. What kind of mental picture had they given them about their child in the future? Are people playing God and making predictions that really are not warranted? Because these are the thoughts and the feelings that the parents bring into that first meeting with the healthcare professional in a children's service. And that needs to be conversed about, that needs to be talked about, because that's where the parent is at, that's where they're starting at. And the parent might not agree with the way in which their child has been described, because it doesn't tally with the reality of what they see the child trying to do at home, trying to get involved with at home, who the child turns to look at when somebody walks in the door, moves from one room to the next, paying attention, the family pet, how the child gets on. This is the stuff of real life, and I think sometimes unintentionally, and there are many, many good people, really good people working in children's disability network teams, but very often they're hamstrung by the system that they're working in. Which, and an example I've often used, Claire, is where on the one hand, the powers that be proclaim that family-centred practice is the policy that drives practice, but yet that same system is asking people on a monthly basis, how many children did you see last month? They're two conflicting and very different agendas, and they're very, very difficult, if not impossible, to blend into what's called genuine family-centred practice. And at the end of the day, coming back to your really good question, at the end of the day, the simplest way of, I suppose, talking about something which is very complex and very difficult often to get your head around is the fact that for children from 0 to 6, at least, if not 0 to 8, their primary learning environment, whether this is accepted or not, their primary learning environment is their family environment. And that means that the primary focus of children's disability network teams actually has to be parenting and supporting parents and families to provide the kind of environment so the child can be the best he or she can be engaged in real life routines and activities in the family, and function as well as the child can in terms of participating in family routines, rituals, activities, relationships, and so forth.
Martin, thank you very much for joining us.
Alive and kicking on News Talk. Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Now he's been a chart-topping musician, a professional athlete, and is a relentless mental health advocate. His new book, The Place That Has Never Been Wounded, is not about quick fixes or chasing happiness. It's about finding that steady core inside you, blending mindfulness, deeply personal stories, philosophy, and an accompanying soundtrack. It's a guide to coming home to yourself. He's also touring the country next month, so we're delighted to welcome Niall Breslin in studio now. You're very welcome.
How are you?
I'm good, and it's funny to have you sitting here in front of me, because I almost feel like I've had your heart and soul in my hands and in my head for the last little while. I mean, you've literally poured that into this work, haven't you?
Yeah, I think because I wrote a book before that was obviously quite personal as well. And more, I think that last book was more the coming to terms with what I had gone through. This book is more about those moments that we all get hit with. Everybody gets hit with this stuff. Nobody gets out of this world unscathed. And it's sometimes people go, oh, you shouldn't say that. That is just the truth. We all go through grief. We all go through relationship issues, health issues. Most of our life is grand and go crack and everything's great, but sometimes we get derailed. And this book was about, you know, probably historically with me, when things like this would have happened, I would have went off the rails. And I would have used it as an excuse to go off the rails. Not necessarily just in a negative way with alcohol and drugs or whatever, but with exercise or work or obsessiveness. I do everything except deal with it. And this book is about responding to it rather than reacting to it. And some of the things that have happened, as I said, people who might have read the book will, well, that actually happened to me last year. Or these are universal things. And one of the ideologies and philosophies of mindfulness, and I wouldn't start with this as a philosophy if I had my own ideology, is suffering is universal. It's something we all experience. And ultimately, we've created a society that doesn't let us express that. And we internalize it. And you internalize that stuff, it's very painful. So this book is about not doing that.
And you're at pains to say that throughout the book, and it's a message I often put out there myself, particularly in this health and wellness sphere. Even though you've got all this experience, education behind you, you're saying, I don't have this figured out all the time. I'm not sitting up here in a mountain going, do what I do and life will be great. And I think that's so important. It makes the message way more accessible to people.
No one does. No one does. That's one thing I've learned in my work and study is that anyone who comes on and pontificates about the human mind like if it all figured out is not being honest. The human mind, I don't think, will ever be figured out. But the beauty of mindfulness, it's not about figuring out the human mind, it's about observing it. You learn to observe the mind, almost like your own mind, like it's not yours. Like you're able to see it and you're able to detach from it. And there's, I do think really great quotes are quite useful sometimes, but the Shunryu Suzuki quote says, open your front door, open your back door, let your thoughts walk through the house, just don't serve them tea. Like I used to make them like bourbon. I was Mrs. Doyle. Like I was pouring tea. I wouldn't let them leave. And that's what happens with thoughts. When they all come together and they all park, they can be overwhelming. So mindfulness is about insight. It's not about relaxation. There is myths around this and it's about being able to watch yourself. Like it's almost not like you. But yeah, as I said, like even, you know, I read your book, especially around things like diet culture. You know, people make these big weighty claims about things without knowing the human or the personality type or the experience of that individual. And it's important to set that out when you're talking about stuff like this. We're not all the same. We all have different ways of coming into the world and different things that I find stressful. You might be going, oh, that's grand. Doesn't mean it's not stressful. It's very important that we do that. So yeah, I didn't want to speak from a place like from hierarchy, like I've all this figured out. And that's the one thing I've learned. The one thing I've learned in all my learning and study is we don't know that much. And I think we have to admit that. And it's okay that we don't. And there's lots we do know. But I don't think we've got full understanding of the human mind.
Let's talk about it then, The Place That Has Never Been Wounded. I mentioned there is an album, a soundtrack to accompany it. So what came first, the music or the book, or was it always a double concept?
The album. The music. The concept actually came first, the Meister Eckhart quote. I always loved that quote. I love the idea of it because it's a quote that says, you know, so much of what we talk about is what we don't have or what we need more of. And I'm a firm believer that there's something in all of us that has got us this far. And it's kind of a steady part. Some people have different names for us. Some people might be religious. They might think it's God. Some people think it's their soul or their spirit. Some people just think it's within all of us. I think it's within all of us. And that's the place that's never been wounded. So I love that concept. So then I said, how do I write music that relates to that? that feels like it relates to that. So it's not, it's emotive. It settles and creates a mood. And I wrote this music. I was terrified to play it to anyone because, like, I don't know if this is any good. Louise, who's a composer herself, was like, you need to release this stuff. This stuff is actually releasing something in her and me. And I was like, maybe it'll do it for other people. So that was it. And then I felt myself explaining the album so much. I was like, you know what? The best way to explain this is to write a book. Because there's context in a book. Like, I was doing these little social media posts trying to get some kind of context. I was like, no, let's write a book. I didn't really want to write a book because it's a lot of work, as you know. There's a lot of work in it. And I was like, do I have time for this? But then I felt it was absolutely the right thing to do.
And that quote, I've been thinking about it for a long time. I'd never really considered that there's a place within us that has never been wounded, that there's something that nothing can touch, no trauma, no experience, that underneath it all, there's a steadiness. It was a real mind blow moment for me. I'd never really thought that there was a part that remained unscathed, not unshaken, but actually unscathed.
Yeah. And I think, and there's parts of us that are, you know, overwhelmed by the world. Like, there's parts of me that still remain very affected by my experiences, that still feel, you know, when you wake up in the middle of the night, when you're sweating, there's still that part of me, but there's another part of me. And I think sometimes, like, I look at these different forms of psychological approaches, like Adler psychology, and the idea that, you know, even the Viktor Frankl psychology of, you know, you pick your own attitude in any given set of circumstances. I never use what I went through as an excuse to treat anyone any differently. I was very aware that there was a part of me that was consistently steady and able to get me through. And I look back at some of the experiences I had, even when I used to play, you know, when I was playing rugby, I was in such a dark place. Like, I don't know what in the name of God got me through that. But I used to always ask, what is it? What's getting me up and what's getting me through this? Playing matches when I wasn't sleeping, you know, self-medicating with Xanax and all sorts before games. Something got me through. And I think in terms of health, we have to empower people to understand that doesn't mean life isn't brutally tough sometimes. It just means there's something that consistently stays with us. And in mindfulness, we use metaphors around the mountain and the lake specifically. And the mountain in any given season is bombarded with, God knows, especially in Ireland, 10 different types of weather: frost, snow, heat, wind, rain, constant rain. And the surface is constantly changing in the mountain, but the mountain never changes. It's still the same. And there's a quote that you're not in the mountains are in you. And I always liked that idea. So that's what we're trying to say to people. The surface being the emotions, the thoughts, the feelings that we all have. And below it is that steady part of us that's embedded and it's strong. And in mindfulness, we have to be very careful because there's this idea of spiritual bypassing as well, where people go, well, I meditate, so I don't care about anyone else. That's selfishness. That's not meditation. You have to care about those around you. You have to care about your community. You have to care about how people are treated, and you have to care about yourself. It's all interlinked. And I think sometimes in this space, it can sound a little bit, well, I look after myself. So, you know, that's not how community works. Community, we have to care about other people, which unfortunately is why this modern culture feels very difficult for people, because we're not doing that. There's too much division. So yeah, mindfulness is very powerful, but I think it's been diluted and simplified too much in how we communicate it.
Yeah, and people are overwhelmed. People have so much going on. It's like another thing on the to-do list that they just can't get to. And I loved how you even rounded off the book with this reminder, you actually can't do this stuff wrong. Stop worrying about how long, where, what cushion, you know, are you doing it right? You cannot do it wrong once you pull yourself to the present moment as often as you can.
And it doesn't have to be formal. So there's two types of practice. There's formal practice, which is, I'm going to meditate, I'm going to watch the mind, and I'm going to observe the mind, and I'm going to sit with that. That might be 5 minutes. That might just be a 3 minute, like, breathing space, whatever it is. But then there's informal practice, which for me is by far the most powerful. That's the conversation with a loved one. That's taking a walk. That is feeling the present moment and being utterly submerged in it. That's getting people, some people get into cold water. I always joke about that when teenagers ask me, what's mindfulness? I mean, get into cold water. I said, tell me, are you thinking about yesterday or what you have to do tomorrow? They're like, no. I said, that's mindfulness. It's presence. But I think informal practice is really useful. I think, once again, with mindfulness, we have this idea that it's performative, that we show people we're doing it. This isn't a performance. This is an internal place you're going to. It's no one else's. It's just yours. It's your space. No one else's space. And I think it is, to me, a very powerful tool, but it's not a tool that I push on people. It's something you have to come to. And if you think you're living a perfectly balanced life and, you know, you're not being rinsed by the chaos of social media and everything else, brilliant, rock and roll, you don't need it. But if you feel like I do, like I'm a man wearing a badly fitting suit in a culture that does not fit me, then maybe look at going in there and having a look, and don't be so terrified of that mind.
And it's draining, isn't it? It's draining to be constantly projecting into the future and everything that's to be done, or ruminating on the past. That moment in the present is almost like a little recharge of the battery. It's a reset.
Yeah. The dare mind I read a lot you, of work, yeah.
Dare I read you a section from your own book?
You dare.
Because I think it just really sums it up so importantly, and especially on a health and wellness show. And the only reason I'm asking you to read it is because I'm going to read a few lines and then skip down to a few lines, okay. Only for time. In a culture drunk on self-improvement, constantly tweaking, fixing, optimizing every last corner of the self, maybe the most radical act is this: stop. Stop fiddling, stop apologizing, just be. Sit there in the glorious, chaotic sprawl of who you already are and know that it is somehow enough. Meditation doesn't make any of that tidier, but it helps us stay with it, all of it, the beautiful and the unbearable, the silence and the noise, no flinching, no edits, just presence. Life isn't a finish line to cross. It's what's unfolding right now, in the margins and pauses. Live the life in front of you rather than chasing one that's always just out of reach. And I just think that is so powerful, because people still think, myself included by times, but why? Why do we need to be present? And why do we need to have mindfulness? And that's why, because if we don't, we're missing the life in front of us.
I think, to be honest with you, when you read that out like you did there, I think that was me saying it to myself more than trying to tell to everyone else to do that. Because I get caught up in this as well. I get caught up in this idea that your happiness lies in achievement, or you have to do more, or you have to prove yourself to other people. That's just our life experiences of maybe, you know, a teacher that said something to you that made you feel insecure about yourself. And we start living it out. A lot of this book is me telling myself that these are reminders. I'm not lecturing to the audience reading it. And I am quite good at being present because I've worked on it. But that does not mean that that is my natural state. That is something I have to be consciously aware of. And like a good example of that is you're driving home to Mullingar and you're going to see your parents. You actively make the decision. You pass Kinnegad and the M4. You go, when I get home to them, I am with them fully. Actively making this decision. I have a lot going on in my life. I have a lot to do. But when I'm there and I'm drinking tea with them at the table, that's it. And you really make that decision before you actually enter into it. And that to me is something I have to do and I'm good at. And if I'm meeting somebody, I do my best to go, I have to be fully present with them. Or if I'm doing something, or if I'm writing music, or I'm performing music. And I'm very lucky that I get to do something that naturally brings me into a flow state. And performing music is probably, above sport and everything else I've done, is probably the thing that gets me there the most. So I know what it feels like to be present, and I like it. I like that feeling. It's a lovely feeling. It's a much better feeling sometimes, because sometimes you're being present and you're like, I hate this. This is chaotic. I need to get out of this. I need to distract myself and do something. And sometimes that's what you got to do. Maybe it's too intense. Maybe it's too much. And this is what I'm talking about, is that self-inquiry is, you don't learn that. That's something you have to experience and you have to work with. But I think ultimately one of the big themes of the book as well is we have been taught to avoid the things that make us uncomfortable. And I'm sorry, but that's part of life. You have no right to be perfectly comfortable all the time. No one has. And there's a difference between being uncomfortable and unsafe. And I'm always very clear on that. Uncomfortable is maybe an emotion you don't particularly enjoy. Do you think I like really bad anxiety? I don't enjoy it, but I'll sit with that. I won't let it overpower me. And then joy. And then something joyful happens. And it's just like an amazing feeling. And then you want to hold on to that joy all the time. And that dissipates too. Nothing stays static. And that's the key of this work, is impermanence. Everything changes. The happiness changes. The sadness changes. And we move on to the next thing. And we just stay with it all. And I think that is all I know about the mind. And the other thing I know a lot for sure is that I come back to this time and time again, is the importance of community. It's so important. Like, we know there's a lot about mental health. We just don't know. Honestly, we just don't know the answer to it. It's so confusing. But there's things for sure we know. Good communities and peer support. Like, and everyone listening to this has the capacity. People will go, well, I'm not an expert. You don't need to be. To build a good community, to be a supportive peer, you don't need to be anything, only a decent person. And anyone listening to this, I'm sure they're that. So we all have the capacity to do that.
You wrote a number of very personal stories in the book, from your mom being in hospital to yourself and Louise having a miscarriage. And I almost feel uncomfortable asking you to trawl over that. I felt it certainly in the promo for my own book. People kept asking me what it was like to fight with my parents and leave home at 18. And it felt strange to keep discussing it. But I think it's important to talk to you about it, because we don't often get a male perspective on miscarriage, on our parents being ill. We don't have that openness to heartache in that way.
Yeah, and I thought about it, whether I wanted to talk about it. And there was two reasons I wanted to talk about it. Firstly, I felt that, you know, as you said, even the male perspective, most of my life, when something like that happens or there's grief, my instinct is to look to everybody else to see if they're okay. That's what I do. I'm a
protector,
sometimes called self-sacrifice or whatever you want to call me. That's my initial instinct. And that was the first time in my life where I was, my sole responsibility in that moment was Louise. That was it. And in that, I was also able to go, how do I feel here? How am I showing up here? Where is this in my body? And there's no framework to teach you how to deal with it. There's nothing I've read since then that has made it any easier. It's definitely made me feel more, connected that other people have experienced it. But it's still a pain you have to go through. And the prime example of why I talked about that was, in the past, that would have left me for dead. I know how I would have responded to that. And I would have acted out. I probably would have been very difficult to be around. But in that moment, I responded to it. And the best way I responded to it was like, I'm going to talk about this. And I'm going to talk about certain elements of it. I'm going to write about it. There were certain elements of it that I don't think we talk about. I think the idea, as I said, and it's no one's fault, walking through a hospital, watching people walking out with their children while you were going in, it was particularly brutal and difficult. But even my mother, that was a really difficult situation for me. And she was, we really were very lucky she didn't die. And she was going in for a routine heart procedure, like a biopsy and whatever the machine is. I don't know what the machine is, hit her heart. And I had a huge traumatic experience. And she ended up in ICU for many, many days. And it was sitting beside her in the bed thinking, she's going to die. And the kind of what goes through your head in that moment, and all the fears and the reversals, because she's lying there, as said in the book, naked, vomiting, and you're rubbing her back. But there's a really funny story in it where her blood pressure was really low. So I was like, oh my God, like the doctor was like, we have to get her blood pressure. We can't get her blood pressure up. And someone had stuck an IKEA sticker on the bed, like it was a little kind of half cut IKEA sticker. And I asked the doctor, was the bed from IKEA? And he kind of looked at me and goes, it's like a 100,000 euro bed. It's not from IKEA. And I was like, well, there's an IKEA sticker on it. But the thing is, my mother's blood pressure raised when I said that, because she was like, what are you talking about, you dope? So I think the Nordic efficiency and her son's stupidity kind of saved her life.
And ironically, it brought her back to the present moment.
It did bring her back. She was like, what is this guy talking about? But I just remember, yeah, it's just that moment of, and at that point, you know, this book isn't about grief. It's not about grief. Grief is just something that we all experience. And I think it was really important to talk about. I talked about Vicky Phelan as well, a very good friend of mine and somebody who I'd had these discussions. But grief is the single best subject to teach people how to be present with the people they love. It is the strongest motivation to say to you, there will come a point in your life where you do not have that choice. So now that you have the choice, make sure you choose the right one. So that's why I kind of wrote about it. And in terms of, you know, the miscarriage, that chapter is about love. It's not necessarily about grief. It's about what was real in that moment and what mattered. And I think that was what I was trying to get across. But yeah, I think it's tough writing about these things, but I think it makes them relatable.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a book where you're coming in here like swaying out ways of telling people how to beat anxiety. I'm going like, I don't know. But I'll tell you, these are the things that I go through, like you probably, and everyone else that reads it and listens to it. And, that's just something I wanted to talk about. And from a male perspective, you know, I can only talk about my perspective. My perspective was I felt responsible and protective of my partner, but also deeply heartbroken. And you have to kind of, you have to find a way to navigate that.
Well, thank you for pouring your heart and soul into this book and into this music. I texted you very early on to it being released to say that I was playing it to my 12-year-old daughter at night when she would feel a bit anxious and get those butterflies in her tummy, thinking about all kinds of big feelings. And it really worked. You know, it was a real gift for me to be able to give her. And that's what you want to be able to give people, that connection to the presence. So we're going to play out with one of those tracks. You've chosen The Place That Has Never Been Wounded. It is the title of the album and the book. What can you tell us about this piece of music we're about to hear?
Well, the final meditation in the album is this moment where you see something in the distance and you're kind of following it. It's a very, very powerful Buddhist meditation. And you don't know what it is, and you're magnetized towards this figure because it just feels so warm and strong and compassionate and powerful. And you keep walking towards the figure, trying to figure out who it is, and you can't keep away from them. You're so curious, and you realize over the course of meditation, this is you. It's you who's been walking towards. This is the place that's never been wounded. It never left you. You're just rediscovering it again. And in this piece of music, there's a moment in the meditation where you rediscover and you bring yourself back into yourself again. And I had to make that obviously quite an emotional, emotive piece of music, but also there had to be a moment in that piece of music that felt like that. You're bringing that person into you again. And then when you walk back out into the chaos and the noise, you have that. You realize that you've found it again. And when people say, I have to find, you know, I have to get that place. It's there. It's always been there. There's just too much noise and you're not listening to it. You're not finding it. This piece of music is the symbolic of the moment. You find it again. And I think people, especially live, you can see it in the audience. It does get them and it's meant to get them. And that's perfectly okay.
Yeah. This is a very, very special piece of work. The book and the music. The Place That Has Never Been Wounded. A Mindful Journey Home to Yourself. Niall Breslin, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Cheers, Claire.
Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna. Sunday morning at 8 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.